running a little late. Let me introduce myself, first of all. My name is Clive Crook. I'm a writer and editor with The Atlantic Monthly. And we're here to have a conversation this evening about foreign perceptions of the United States. I'll just very quickly introduce the members of the panel before we go any further, in case some of you are surprised not to see some of the people you were expecting. We've had to change our speakers because of various logistical issues during the course of the day. But we've ended up with a fantastic panel, as I'm sure you'll agree when I've introduced them all. At the far end of the stage there is Rob Riemann, who is the founder and head of the Nexus Institute, which is a cultural philosophical think tank in the Netherlands. Then we have Shashi Tharoor. Those of you who've been attending sessions at this conference will already have encountered Shashi. He is the head of public affairs for the United Nations and might very well be the next Secretary General of the United Nations. Then we have Danny Ayalom, who is Israel's ambassador to the U.S., and Kumar Kawar, who is the Jordanian ambassador to the U.S. I don't want to impose anything like a structure on this conversation, but I will start just by framing my own perception of this issue. And actually, I'll use that at the same time as a way of apologizing for my own presence on this platform. A panel speaking on foreign perceptions of the U.S. should really be moderated by an American. And as you probably gathered, I'm not an American. But I want to plead to be accepted, at least for the course of this evening, as an honorary American. I moved over to the U.S. last summer. After months of wrangling with the INS, I was finally allowed into the country. And provided I can stay in their good books, I intend to stay. So I think it would be fair to describe me as a militant Americanophile. Now, one of the reasons, it's only one, but I'm not making this up, it is one of the reasons I wanted to leave Britain to come and work in the U.S. and to stay in the U.S., was that I had an increasing apprehension over the years that I was living in a country where I didn't feel at home. My own attitude to the U.S. has long been one of admiration on a philosophical level, from dating back to when I began studying political philosophy at university. America struck me as the right model for the way you run a democracy. But beyond that, as somebody from Britain, I felt that my country owed the U.S. an enormous debt for the way it came to our rescue during the Second World War and for the way it protected us from the Soviet Union during the Cold War and eventually destroyed that enemy that was threatening first and foremost Western Europe, not the United States. So I wanted to feel that there was an acknowledgement in the country of that kind of sentiment. And increasingly, it seems to me, even in Britain, which in many ways is a mid-Atlantic country, not a European country, that sense of affection and respect for the U.S. has been beginning to fade. I remember in the week of 9/11, at that time I was working for The Economist magazine. As you recall, 9/11 was a Tuesday. We were close on our press deadlines for that week, and I was in charge of the magazine that week because the editor was away. We had to scrap the entire magazine and fill it from scratch with the 9/11 story. So I worked more or less 3 days without sleeping straight through until we began printing the magazine on Thursday afternoon. I remember very well going home that Thursday evening, absolutely exhausted and in a somewhat emotional state, because I'd had several days not only of getting the magazine right for that week, but also of phoning and exchanging emails with friends and colleagues in the U.S. So I was worn out in every sense. When I got home that evening, to get the adrenaline level down, I decided to vegetate in front of the TV for a couple of hours before going to bed. And what should I see on the TV but a BBC discussion program called Question Time, with a format not unlike this, in which a group of panelists answered questions from the audience about 9/11. What else? And what astonished me was the tone of the questions from the audience. Question after question took the form, well, now perhaps you can see, now perhaps America will understand what the world thinks of it. Now, I promise you I'm not exaggerating. This program caused a massive scandal, and I don't want to argue that it's typical in any sense. The BBC was forced to apologize for it, and it turned out that they'd made a mistake in the people they'd invited to take part in this specially invited audience. There were an awful lot of leftists, anti-Americans, anti-globalization people. In other words, it was a kind of professional anti-American audience. But nonetheless, it was a startling thing to see. And I remember the US ambassador to Britain was on that panel, and about two-thirds of the way through the program, it was obvious that he was weeping because of this response. It was obviously not what he'd expected. I felt deeply ashamed. And that night, actually, I began to plot my departure. So I'm saying that as part of my plea to be considered an honorary American. I'm going to put hostile questions to the foreigners on my right, on your behalf. But not too many of them, because we will move very quickly to taking questions from the audience, which is really the point of this event in the first place. What I thought I would do is ask each of our panelists just to speak for a few minutes, two to five minutes, to keep it short in order to give you all a chance to ask questions, but just to give their take on how they feel foreign perceptions of America stand at the moment, how serious a problem is anti-Americanism in the world, how far is that sentiment, to the extent that it exists, how far is it America's fault, what ought America to be doing about it? So, Kumar, perhaps I could start with you.
Thanks, Clive. It's Karim.
I'm so sorry.
And I wish we can turn the lights on, because that would be more comfortable for us and to have a conversation if it doesn't bother the cameraman. We hosted Tom Friedman one evening at the embassy in Washington. And the next day, he wrote an article saying, do you remember when Arabs used to name streets after American presidents? And that came after a conversation he had with a friend of ours who used to live in Beirut, and so did Tom. And that has changed quite a lot from those days. One, looking at the positive aspect of it, I received my education here in the United States, and that's not unusual for many Jordanians. Actually, more than half of our cabinet are U.S. educated. And when you look at many of the Jordanians and Arabs that have studied in the United States, those are, frankly, the best American ambassadors. They're the ones who have experienced the American way of life, the American culture. They appreciate American values, and they take those back home with them, and they share them with their community. That said, today, in opinion polls, still the large majority of Arabs and Muslims want to come and study in U.S. institutions. They respect American advancement in technology, and they look up to America. They actually hold America to the highest standards of justice. And those are all the positive aspects, even those that come and go through the immigration process, which discriminates against them. Still, many of them want to come and visit again. On the other hand, as you all know, the opinion polls such as Pew and Zogby revealed that there's a large also number of Arabs and Muslims, and that's also a majority, and I can speak for Jordan, where those who still hold the United States in a favorable opinion are probably less than 10% of our population, which is a problem. And this is not an issue about public diplomacy. This is not that the Arab street as such does not see what America is trying to get across. It is an issue of foreign policy. And unfortunately, there are many who subscribe to conspiracy theories. And now they see both, they see the United States through two prisms. One is the Arab-Israeli conflict, which is a long-standing conflict, and that has affected many people's views. But the other and more recent one is the war in Iraq. If I take the more recent one in Iraq, they used to hear about rumors about the abuses in Abu Ghraib, along with all the many other conspiracy theories that this is about oil. This is the war in Iraq is on behalf of the State of Israel. Those are the opinions that they had, which unfortunately for them became true when the images from Abu Ghraib were presented. And therefore, those for them were no longer conspiracy theories, but were proof. This is going to take a long time to correct, coupled with the detainees in Guantanamo and so on. But we believe that the United States can change a lot of that. And where we can make the most progress is on the Arab-Israeli conflict. And I use the Arab-Israeli conflict because, one, there are countries, Arab countries, that are still in conflict, primarily Syria and Lebanon. But when we look at it from Jordan, and Jordan, we are stakeholders in the peace process. We have a great peace treaty with Israel, which has been beneficial to both sides. And this can be the model for many other countries to follow. And what King Abdullah and the late King Hussein have always put themselves in Israeli shoes and looked at the conflict from that angle and said, how can we have an Israel that exists throughout the region, from the Atlantic to the Indian Ocean? But I believe the United States can do a lot more by continuing to keep that welcome sign on the whole nation, that all people can come and visit and experience the American way of life, so that there can be better understanding of what America stands for. And also have Americans travel to our part of the world. There is a notion here that Americans tend to close up whenever there is a threat. And that is dangerous as well. We don't want to see the United States being isolated from the rest of the world. The Peace Corps is a great example of well-intentioned American people that change people's lives in our part of the world through the good work that they do. And they become Jordanian ambassadors in that case when they return here, because they have experienced our culture as well. At the end of the day, I believe there are universal values that we all adhere to. Every mother, whether she is in Jordan or in Israel or in the United States, she wants the best education for her children and aspires to have the best standards of living. And this is what we all share. It's that common humanity that we need to break through the constraints that we've had, and unfortunately how the media, whether it is media in our part of the world, such as Al Jazeera, and how they cover issues and how they present them, but also media here in the United States.
Okay, thank you very much. Daniel, I'll come to you next.
Okay. Well, let me say at the outset, can you hear me all?
Good.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay. Can you hear me now? Good. Well, let me say at the outset, I guess for the sake of free disclosure, that the United States is the best friend and ally of Israel. Right. And also I would like to say, to add to that, that personally, I have married an American woman, which introduced me to her family, so I have an American family. I, like Karim, I got part of my education in the United States. So I'm not impartial to what's happening here, and of course to its image and its policies. I do admire the United States, like many Israelis, and I really love it. The United States is really a benevolent power which has helped our civilization.
Can't hear.
Can you hear me now?
Good idea. That's a great cooperation, Jordan-Israeli, which we all look at. Thank you very much. Ingenious.
That was staged.
Now we're going to hear Daddy in stereo.
Okay. No, actually, I rather liked his mic. But that's okay. Well, I would say Israelis love and admire the United States, not just because it was American soldiers back in 1945 who were the first to arrive at the Nazi concentration camps and that really liberated the victims of the Holocaust. Not because America was the one decent country which was the first to recognize Israel's independence after 2,000 years in our homeland and the support throughout the years, shared values and all that. I'm trying to get out of this box of being an Israeli and look at the United States from, let's say, a more universal point of view. And to that, I would say, and you quite correctly mentioned, it was the United States who saved the world three times, at least, in the last century. World War I, World War II, the Cold War. If I look back, I remember as a child, I was really riveted by the innovation of Americans, whether it was Thomas Alva Edison, who really harnessed electricity to the benefit of all of us, or whether it was Stevenson, which I believe was the one who invented the steam engine, and through that myriad of other many, many inventions. It was America who put the first man on the moon, which inspired people all over. I remember I was a teenager then. I really felt great pride of being not necessarily Israeli or American, but human being who could really be a part of this great endeavor of the United States. And if you look at vaccines, if you look at the help, I mean, maybe proportionally, it's not matching other countries like Scandinavia or others, but in absolute terms, I mean, you support the United Nations. You support now UNESCO or any other UNDP or you name it. It's your money which helps AIDS in Africa, and it's your political power which prevents killing anywhere you would see in the globe. And I would like, with your permission, Kawar, to try and divert attention from the Israeli-Arab conflict right now, not because we have talked about it too much, because I think there is much more to it. When you talk about the United States, whether its influence in the South Pacific Rim, or in Europe, or in Latin America, or in Africa, I don't think the world would have had this stability as it has now without the United States. And it's the United States citizens and soldiers who pay with their blood for the stability, for the well-being of every individual in this globe, whether it's directly or indirectly. And when I see the image of the United States, not just in the Arab or Muslim world, whether it's in Europe or other places, it's quite deplorable that there are countries, populations, that see the United States as more threatening to world peace and security than Iran. I guess it goes to prove that no good deed goes unpunished. And the Americans have too many good deeds, and I think this is why maybe you're in such a bad shape from the image point of view. Should it bother you? I think this is the right question for the policymakers in Washington and for Americans. I've crisscrossed America, and this is a great land. I appreciate the American values, from the family cell to the larger community. I like the entrepreneurship. And what you have introduced, really, in international policy, which is compassion, which is idealism, and we need that. It's a cynical world, I know that, but we need that. And when there is a threat, you are not bashful in treating it, whether it was the evil empire or whether it is international terrorism, which we suffer from today. Now, it is deplorable that people don't see it like that. I can maybe later on, I don't want to just monopolize this, but maybe later on if we will have a chance to try to explain why it is the case after all what you have done, we can deal with that later. I think the question for you, for American, is should be bothered by it? I would say yes. Should that affect our foreign policy? I would say absolutely not. Because it is too important to keep this world that we share together in a safe place.
Thank you. Shashi?
Well, my own admiration for America goes back to my childhood. And in fact, it wasn't all that typical growing up in India because there was a certain perspective on the U.S. in those days in the context of, and of course in every country, as Danny has already indicated, there is always a national angle through which one views the U.S. And certainly in those days, the U.S. was seen as not particularly friendly towards Indian aspirations during the Cold War, ally of our neighbor Pakistan, all of that. But I remember when I entered university, in college, we had a theoretical choice between studying the history. I was a history major, and this was in our second year, between studying the history of the Far East, China and Japan, and studying the history of the United States. But the course wasn't actually offered. It was purely theoretical. The course wasn't there. So I went to the head of the Department of History and said, well, look, I'd like to study American history. Theoretically, this is available to me. And he said, my dear boy, Americans have no history. the usual old world attitude towards all of you. Everyone said, well, whatever there is of it, I'd like to study it. So what can I do? And he said, well, look, if you conduct a petition and get 10 students to sign up, we'll offer a course. And I managed to conduct a petition and get 17 students to sign up. And the course has been offered ever since. So I feel a certain contribution that I helped make towards better Indian understanding of America, at least in Delhi University. But I say this simply because there was an extraordinary amount of curiosity about this remarkable country. And don't forget that for many of us around the world, and certainly in the world, in the English-speaking world, or the world in which English was spoken and available, American influence was always available at the popular level. There was music, there were books, there were films. And so people saw an America, even if it was an America they'd never set foot in, but an America of the imagination. And that was an America that we all greatly admired. And I would say that even to this day, where you find hostility towards or criticism of America, where you find demonstrations in the streets of various cities around the world against America, there's a curious paradox that inhabits the mind of every one of those demonstrators. Because you'd often find the same people, by the way, lining up for a visa to the United States if they could get it. I think the real slogan would be, Yankee, go home, but take me with you.
Yes.
You know, so that level of consciousness and admiration is real, it's universal, it's widespread. Then why does America have a problem? I mean, I think part of it, and I'm sure Danny will forgive me the biblical allusion, is the Goliath syndrome. You are the biggest, I shouldn't say you, but you will soon, I suppose.
It worked.
Yes, exactly. You are not just honorary, but you've already established yourself in my mind. But America is seen as this huge, extremely powerful nation. And as in most sporting contests, where people tend instinctively to want to root for the underdog, in most international situations, the U.S. is seen as the behemoth, and whoever the U.S. is supporting, therefore, tends to get the rough end of the popular stick. And I know it sounds naive and simplistic, but it's true. I mean, people do tend very often to enjoy seeing the big, tough, strong figure get a bloody nose, even if, in fact, the big, strong, tough figure is the one who stands for the right values and principles in the world, as Danny has pointed out, against those who, in fact, in many ways, conduct themselves in a manner that none of us would like to live under. But this is, I think, part of the psychology, if you like, of what you've called anti-Americanism. I hesitate, though, to generalize too much, because the most fervently anti-American individuals I come across, whether they're demonstrators in streets or whether they're intellectuals writing in sophisticated left-wing publications, aren't anti-everything American. I mean, they're not anti American literature, they're not anti-American films or American music, or even McDonald's, perhaps. I mean, they might be anti-McDonald's, I don't want to say. But there is a sense in which aspects of American policy, in particular issues, that generate, if you like, a certain amount of reaction that's negative, get translated into a reaction that's vituperative to an extreme, and that, therefore, people tend to think of as anti-American, whereas, in fact, even within that criticism, there is a lot of respect for a number of aspects of the American experience that I hope Americans here don't forget. Final point, I'd say that in appreciating that what America stands for in the world is more than just governmental action, more than just foreign policy. It's also, I mean, I think I mentioned another panel, so forgive me for repeating it, but when the French Foreign Minister Hubert Védrine spoke of America as a hyperpower, an hyperpuissance, he wasn't just referring to American military power. He was referring to America as a home of Microsoft and IBM and Disney and Hollywood and Boeing and Kodak and, you know, you name every conceivable, and McDonald's for that matter, and Starbucks, every product that, or the majority of every product that consumers around the world were familiar with, took for granted, associated themselves with. And that remains. That is also America. And those are things that people can't do without. I mean, it may sound like a bit absurd to sort of talk of somebody leaving a Starbucks to go and, you know, throw a stone at a passing American convoy. But, I mean, the fact is that that is part of reality today. And so I would simply say that perhaps America should take the broader view and accept that there's an awful lot in the world that you do stand for, that you do represent, that some may like and some may dislike. There were riots against the introduction of Coca-Cola into France in the 1940s. I mean, this is not in and of itself surprising. People will resist, if you like, the encroachments of something so much larger, so much more powerful, so much wealthier than anything that they felt they themselves are or represent. But at bottom, all the things that you have going for you, assuming the majority of this room is full of Americans, I think you can be positive about. I think the world will occasionally demur, and that these may be things you can take in stride. Certainly the values, the ideals, I'm glad Danny talked about the idealism that America has introduced into the world, that remains. And sometimes you are reproached for not living up to your own ideals. I'll stop there.
Thank you. Well, Rob, since I've opted out, you're the European on the platform.
Well, first of all, I saw the same television program on the BBC as you did. And I was as stunned as you are. And as you may, you must have the same experience. It only got worse. I was surprised because, 2001, I traveled to New York and Chicago and Los Angeles, and that was my America. And then suddenly, you are confronted with. I remember vividly we were invited at a dinner party for a NATO ambassador. NATO happens to be in Brussels, so there were a lot of Belgian people, were Belgian intellectuals, and there was a guy who was even of the Royal Academy, which is a big thing in Brussels, who, I have to admit, two glasses of wine, and then told me, he said, but do you know why the Americans only had D-Day on the 6th of June 1994? I said, well, apparently they needed some time. He said, no. They knew that Europe would be economically in ruins, and so that they could conquer us on an economic level, and that's... I was stunned. Then I heard stories about from a friend of mine that the American school, there is an American school in Brussels. But this is a Western European phenomenon. I don't want to focus on Belgium. But that after 9/11, the American kids were told by their teachers, but you have to know, this is, all to blame your own country, Then we can make a whole list of intellectuals, including Nobel Prize winners like Dario Fo. He said, 9/11, that was an attack on globalism and capitalism, and look how many victims made globalism and capitalism. So who cares about 3,000 people? It was for me the first experience of what is known as the betrayal of intellectuals. The betrayal of the intellectuals is not a new phenomenon, but for me it was the first time I really experienced it. Okay, that's you cannot underestimate, and not that long ago, there was, I think 2 years ago, your ambassador to NATO, Valerie Nuland, came and a dinner party was organized, and I was, for whatever reason, invited as well. And we tried to inform her, you cannot underestimate the anti-Americanism in Europe. You will speak with the political elite. The political elite is different. But the public opinion, and the truth of the matter is intellectuals still have an influence on European public opinion. It's not the case here in America. Intellectuals have not that much influence on public opinion. But there was a strong, strong, strong anti-Americanism, and unfortunately, but not as a surprise to the Israeli ambassador, is the shortcut to anti-Semitism. So one of the things you can hear frequently is, but you know, America, that's Wall Street and Hollywood, and you know who are behind Wall Street and Hollywood, so, okay. So that is a big phenomenon, and it really has a real impact on the public opinion. The second remark I want to make is that my great intellectual hero is Thomas Mann. And Thomas Mann came as a refugee from Nazi Germany to your country in 1938. And when he was in the harbor of New York, he said, "Where I am is German culture." So Hitler went, "They are not, I am German culture." Not much later, he was invited to the White House and Roosevelt, and then Roosevelt already upgraded him. I said, "I'm now meeting European civilization." So from Germany, he was already European civilization. And not much later, together with his friend Albert Einstein, they were invited by NBC Radio for a talk show. And they both said, "You know, I am an American." And they were, you know, that was a very honest remark of both of them. "I am an American." Because for so many people, America, the United States of America, was the country which was the improvement of your, and this is how it started, you know, with your founding fathers, the 4th of July, and so on and so forth. And in the 20s and in the 30s, so many people saw, you know, America, that is the improvement. That's the real incarnation of European civilization. So quite easy to say for them, you know, "I am an American." However, 12 years later, in 1950, Roosevelt died, and Thomas Mann, who really made a career here, he became the consultant to the Library of Congress. He gave a big lecture over there. He became close friends with Agnes Meyer, who was married to the owner of the Washington Post. He really became part of the American establishment. In 1950, he turned 75, and he was supposed to give another big lecture at the Library of Congress. And then came a warning to the director of the Library of Congress from the FBI. And because he was on the list of the FBI. Why? Because his children, Klaus and Erika, they got an FBI file in which was written that they were accused in 1950 of premature anti-fascism. That's an FBI invention, premature anti-fascism, with which they meant that they were already anti-fascist before America entered the war. So they must have been communist. And then Thomas Mann decided, "I have to leave this country." And he left very disappointed. What I would like to say is that you're dealing from out of Europe with strong, strong anti-Americanisms, and unfortunately Europe is very much confused, and a lot of ghosts which we saw in the 30s are getting back to Europe. There is a rise of populism, there is a rise of nationalism, there is a rise of anti-Semitism, it's all there again. But at the same time, the serious question for friends of America is, you know, what is the real face of America? What is the real face of America? Because America has different faces. And it not only relates to your present administration and their policies and the useful lies and all these things, but it also fundamentally relates to in which way the United States of America has the capacity to live up to its own values. And then I'm not talking about silly things as, you know, pro-choice or gay marriage. That's nonsense. You know, you should not even have that discussion. But what is it that you're doing with your democracy? And what is it you're doing with your concept of liberty? And what are you doing, you know, with the cultivation of those values? So that's a small start.
Thank you. I'll just ask one quick question of my own before I throw it open to the audience. And it's a little unfair perhaps to put Shashi on the spot, but I guess this question is most naturally directed to you. I agree absolutely with what you say about the Goliath complex. I think that's 9/10, if not more, of America's image problem in the rest of the world. Whichever country had America's power would encounter that kind of the kind of resentment, the kind of background resentment and suspicion that America encounters. And there's not a lot that America can do about that. But a specific complaint that's often made about the U.S. is that it behaves, that it's reluctant to behave in a spirit of compromise, a spirit of cooperation with other countries. It's very often accused of unilateralism. And the Bush administration is held up really as the archetype of unilateralist foreign policy. I often feel that that is an unfair criticism. I'd be interested to hear your view. The reason I think it's unfair is that I think in many contexts where America makes decisions which it feels or the administration feels are in America's national interest, that is regarded as in some sense illegitimate. But that standard is never applied to other countries. To give a couple of specific examples, America is very, very often criticized for failing to ratify the Kyoto Protocol. We've heard about that a lot at this meeting. It's been mentioned several times at sessions I've attended. Another thing that's very often that America is very often criticized for is failing to cooperate with the International Criminal Court. Now, in my view, putting to one side the rights and wrongs of those decisions, there was, I think, a legitimate, valid national interest argument for America to say no to both of those two things. When France or when China or almost any other country with comparable power at the UN stands back from a decision or stands back from cooperating in that way, when is France or China ever accused of unilateralism? The charge is never made. It's simply taken for granted that other countries are allowed, indeed, in some sense, are obliged to pursue their national interest. America somehow isn't allowed to do that.
Well, I mean, there are two things one can say about that. The first is that every country on earth is both unilateral and multilateral. Unilateral usually in its own backyard, multilateral when it comes to larger questions of common humanity and all of that. Problem with America is the whole world is your backyard. So when you're unilateral, it affects everybody else. When France is unilateral or India is unilateral, I dare say, the consequences are felt only in the immediate neighborhood. So that is one of the reasons why there's this particular unfairness. But there is a larger point, I think, lurking behind your question, which is worth addressing, because it's one that gives many thoughtful friends of America pause. And that is that particularly after the Second World War, there was a widespread conviction that America stood for a world run by commonly agreed rules of the road, a world of laws. The U.S. and Franklin Delano Roosevelt and Harry Truman after him did far more than anyone on earth to construct the international institutions that came into being from 45 onwards, the Bretton Woods institutions, the UN as the keystone of this arch. FDR, in his famous speech to the two houses of Congress after Yalta, said the UN has been created precisely because it's the only possible alternative to the kinds of disastrous arrangements, the balance of power politics, the military alliances that had made war inevitable in the first half of the 20th century. And so there was a sense, Truman in the speech in San Francisco when the charter was signed said, we have to accept that America cannot do as it pleases, that we have to make a sacrifice to work with other countries because without that, no organization for world peace will succeed. This is Truman, you know, quote unquote, more or less. That sense was buttressed by the fact that the U.S., in fact, in 1945, paid 50% of the cost of the United Nations. That the sense is that America had such a fundamental stake in a world organized in this way. And that kind of rings oddly today, a few years after so much diplomatic capital has been spent in reducing the American share of the dues from 25 to 22%, which is already a significant break in America's share of global GDP, when there are indeed the various instruments, international instruments, that the U.S. seems to want to seek an exemption from. I mean, You mentioned two examples. One that strikes many friends of America painfully is that the U.S. is the only country on earth that has not ratified the International Convention on the Rights of the Child. The only other exception used to be Somalia, but they didn't have a government. The moment they had a government, they ratified it. So, I mean, you are looking at things where there is a sense that on a number of issues that seem to matter to the rest of the world, dare say with a good deal less sincerity than Washington would bring to these things, because there are countries that ratify legal instruments and don't honor them. America would honor whatever it ratifies. The fact is that nonetheless, there is a sense that America seems to feel on many occasions that the rules it would like the rest of the world to follow don't always apply to it when it doesn't suit it. Mm. And that, I think, is... And I say this, if I may, as a friend and a well-wisher of the U.S. I think that the U.S. gains when it shows the rest of the world that it is prepared to subject itself to the same fetters, the same restraints that it would like the rest of the world to follow. Because if once in a while the U.S. does things because the rest of the world expects it to, that's good, because the rest of the time the rest of the world will be doing things because the U.S. expects it to. Mm.
But do you, as a general rule, see a corresponding willingness to cooperate on the part of, for instance, the European Union with the U.S.? In other words, the demand you're making of the U.S., the suggestion that you're putting to the U.S.
Absolutely.
To be in a more cooperative mode, do you see a corresponding willingness on the other side?
From a U.N. perspective, absolutely. I mean, there's no question that the European Union sees a fundamental interest in working with and strengthening international institutions. And I believe there are some Americans...
Not the WTO, evidently.
Well, I mean, as I said, from a UN perspective, I think that there is a difference. But I don't mean to be negative. Of course the US works with the UN on a whole host of issues all the time. The US is our largest single contributor. It's a permanent member of the United Nations Security Council with a veto. The UN essentially can't do anything if the US doesn't want it to. So there is no question that the US is a key player already.
Right.
And it does work with the UN. Even during the divisions over the Iraq war, those 8 to 9 weeks when the whole world saw the UN being ripped apart by this fundamental disagreement on Iraq, on the same 8 to 9 week period, the same ambassadors and the same Security Council were agreeing on a whole host of other issues that got no reporting attention. Mm-hmm. They were agreeing on East Timor, on Afghanistan, on Congo, on Liberia, and the US was working hand in glove with these other countries. So we do tend sometimes to lose the fact that, yes, there is a lot of real cooperation taking place as well.
We'll take some questions from the audience. I don't know. Do we have a microphone that we can circulate?
We do.
There's a microphone here. Oh, let me see. It's hard to see with the lights. Someone here is being encouraged to ask a question. Can we have the microphone?
Here's a question right here.
This lady here. You'll need
somebody has a mic out there in his hand, though.
Oh, well, you'll be next.
Last month I visited your country. I'm on Jordan and Syria, and it's a beautiful country. But there's a problem that people aren't discussing, and that's the Iraqi refugees that have infiltrated your country. And you've been very generous with them and giving them 3-month visas. And now I understand the visas are going to be reduced to 2-week visas. And, I mean, I've met prisoners from Abu Ghraib and just ordinary people. And they're desperate because they're frightened. And that's our American policy that's caused this problem. What can be done for these people? What can be done for these Iraqi refugees in Jordan is basically my question.
Well, thank you for the question. The question was about the Iraqi refugees in Jordan. We refer to them as Iraqi guests and not as refugees, unlike the Palestinian refugees who live in refugee camps. The Iraqi guests live in apartments and homes that they either rent or buy. They are welcome to stay in Jordan as long as the situation does not allow them to go back, but we hope that that will be sometime soon when they can return to their homes without their lives being jeopardized. Jordan is a country that cannot afford a failure in Iraq, and the numbers of those Iraqis in Jordan has risen from 300,000 after the Gulf War in 91 to an estimate of over 800,000 today. For a population of 5.5 million, which is the population of Jordan, that's quite a huge burden for any country to absorb. And we're doing that on our own without anyone's assistance. That you can imagine is also a burden on our infrastructure, whether it's our water resources or our road network or our school system. So it is quite a burden, but this is what we do also as allies of the United States. And in fact, what hurts the United States also hurts the friends of the United States. But it is our shared responsibility in helping, and hopefully what we are doing, for example, we're training Iraqi police. We've trained over 35,000 during the past 2 years, and hopefully that will contribute to creating a more stable situation in Iraq that would allow them to return.
Thanks very much. There's a question at the back. Thank you for your patience.
Thank you. Well, gentlemen, I think you've been very kind to the United States. I appreciate that. From my perspective as a U.S. citizen, I feel like we've declined in the world with the moral high ground that we did have. And I'm wondering if you agree. I'm wondering if you agree with that assumption I'm making, and if you do, what are your recommendations on how we can regain the moral ground that I believe we've lost?
Do you want to start? Well, I think each of you should have a go at that question.
Well, since I started first, let me be last.
Okay.
Let's go to our European.
Well, that's a good question. It's difficult because, you know, there's can we say that the European Union is living up to its own standards? In many ways, it is not the case. This is the reason why Clive is now here and now living in London any longer. No. Serious things are going on in Europe. And, you know, of course we speak about the European Union, but the truth is the European Union is only a set of institutions and has no base on the people. This is the reason why in France and in the Netherlands, and it would have been in England and in Denmark and Germany, there are no Europeans. So that makes it a little bit difficult for me as an outsider and foreigner to lecture about, you know, what you should do. But one of the things I'm worried about, also listening to things which has been said at this festival, you might have heard Michael Sandel's analysis of what's going on with your democracy and his analysis of the skyboxification, which I thought was an excellent analysis of how fragile the value of democracy is presently in the United States. Now, in Europe, we have some experience with the fact that democracy is not a given thing, and that it, you know, quite quickly can go, and we pay the price for it. And you pay the price for it because, you know, you had to solve this. But so it's absolutely ridiculous to think that you're living in a democracy, and until the year 3000, you're fine, and it will remain a democracy. What Thomas Mann lectured, based on his experience, what happened in Germany and what he saw happening in the United States, because we made some critical remarks, but we tried to do it, you know, as politely as possible, is that you cannot have a democracy if you don't have a capacity to cultivate its quintessential values. Now, this morning it was from the world of technology and science, Billy Joe, who was complaining about the fact that when he wanted to have some books about science and so on and so forth, you cannot find it because the place, all over the place, is Barnes & Noble and Barnes & Noble. The problem with Barnes & Noble is that it's a kind of criminal organization which are not interested in books. But no, it's, again, you know, it's very simple. The concept of democracy relates, among others, that you have an educated public who can make a rational, you know, judgment for themselves and take a certain responsibility. At the very moment that you take away the cultural ground you need, and you have Fox Television and so on taking over, and you have the kitschification of your own politics in which Mr. Rove can make people believe mission accomplished. Please, is there anybody who on Saturday will ask this man, when is the mission accomplished? You see? So listen, and if these things are going on, if you have serious problems with your political culture, if you have serious problems with your education system, if you have serious problems with you know, how to give access of people to, so that they can make their own judgments, so that they are not completely dependable on the mass media and their lies, you have a problem. So that's just, you know, and how to start? Well, you know, stop buying Barnes & Noble.
Danny, do you want to go next?
Yes. Well, actually, I'm reminded, you know, when Thomas Mann is mentioned here, it reminds me of another great American who also came from the old land, Europe, and that was Charlie Chaplin, which I believe came from Britain in the early years of the last century. And when Charlie Chaplin came to New York, and he was accustomed to the European, I guess, traditions, every woman, every lady he met, he used to kiss on her hand. His American friends didn't understand that, and they asked him, why do you kiss every woman on their hand? And the answer of Charlie Chaplin was, well, you have to start somewhere. Now, why am I telling this story? Well, first of all, it's entertaining. It's funny. And secondly, I think it's a difference of culture between the old land and the new land. And before getting to the question about whether the U.S. keeps the high ground or not, what Shashi said about the Goliath syndrome, I'm sure it's part of that in the ill perception of foreigners to the United States. But also I think it's a matter of competition. And if I look at Europe, I think it's a matter of cultural competition, economic competition, but maybe even cultural. I think they, maybe if I can bring some, let's say, adaptation from human frailty, maybe it's a little just jealousy. Here in the United States, you do things better and cheaper. You're more pragmatic, you're entrepreneurial. Maybe you have lost some of maybe the innocence of the Renaissance period and some of the culture and paying attention to all kinds of difference, you know, a butterfly on the blooming of a flower or whatever. But you have great responsibility. And that comes, and a great responsibility comes with leadership. I did not see any other power in the last 50 or so years, maybe even more, who has taken a decision, a real stand, even of the most controversial issues, whether it's Kyoto or matter of peace and war. And not taking decisions is also making decisions, usually the wrong decisions. And for that, I think there is a lot of controversy, and I would urge you to continue with that. I think it fails me to see where the gentleman that asked the question, where the United States has gone back on the moral ground, whether it was in Darfur. I think it was a valiant American, and Bob Zelig was the guy who was really trying to get results over there. Whether it's in Bosnia, or, you know, it wasn't until the American involvement that this ethnic cleansing really stopped. And you can look at any other spots in the world.
Iraq.
The tsunami. Pardon?
Iraq.
Well, Iraq also, you can say, well, Iraq was a question of decision that nobody else there taken. But if you look from the perspective of the United States, and I'm not the one with my humble capabilities to defend the United States position, but I think there was a consensus by the international community of 16 or 17 UN resolutions that tried to call Saddam Hussein to the task with no avail. He was the one who kicked out the inspectors. He is the one who threatened the entire region. He invaded Kuwait. He lodged all these Scud missiles on Saudi Arabia, on Bahrain, on Israel. It was a major sense of instability. And it was believed, not by just the United States, but it was a universal belief that he had weapons of mass destruction. Let me tell you something, and I'm sure I'm not divulging any sensitive intelligence information. Saddam Hussein himself believed he had weapons of mass destruction. Yes. And he was the guy who was willing to use it. So I think it's very easy to judge, and firstly in hindsight, but the United States took a position which no other country dared to do. And I think it was quite patient in doing that. Let me tell you, right from the start, Israel was not involved in that at all. And I'm glad that Karim mentioned, you know, how Jordan's security is at stake. for winning in Iraq. I think it's the entire world, and I think the entire world should support this effort of the United States. I think the Europeans should be on board in much more material help, political support. I think many other countries should be there as well. So you may look at some anecdotal cases like Guantanamo and some misbehavior of individuals, American soldiers in Iraq. But I think the world should judge it by how the United States system responds. And you have a country of the rule of law, and these issues are being dealt with in disciplinary and other measures, which we do not see in other cases. When American soldiers are being murdered and their bodies is being mutilized, it doesn't make the news. But Guantanamo does make the news, which rightly so. I think the United States is held to a higher standard. But I think the response, by and large, of the American authority is very much on the high ground.
Well, I'll be brief since I've spoken so much already. I mean, I think that the two brief points worth making. First is indeed, and it's been made already by so many of us, I won't belabor it, that the issue of the moral high ground relates very much to America's own standards. People have certain expectations of America. America has rightly led the world to have those expectations. And when it seems, as with Abu Ghraib or with Guantanamo or whatever, that the U.S. isn't living up to its own high standard in terms of its conduct, then there are questions legitimately raised. And that's where your concern, I'm assuming, as a questioner comes up. But as Danny has pointed out, it's important that the system examine and interrogate itself about the rightness of these actions. And once the system has done that, the moral high ground will be retained. But a second point I'd like to make is that perhaps we are slightly guilty of sort of a situational judgment here. Because if you really look in terms of the moral high ground in international affairs, America has a lot more of it in recent years than it had 30, 40 years ago, when there was much more of a sense internationally of America professing certain values and betraying them in practice, professing democracy and overthrowing countries which had democratically elected governments, the Guatemalan example, the Iranian example, or professing the value of democracy but supporting dictatorships when it suited America to support them. Those were the kinds of things that really cost you the moral high ground in many people's judgment. America doesn't do that anymore, hasn't done that for a good decade or two. And that, I think, is important to remember. No, I'm serious. I mean, I didn't mean to sound as if I was slighting that. I think that America itself, there's much less of a gap between America's professed values internationally and its conduct in terms of foreign policy, and that does give you a certain moral high ground. So where you fail or where you lapse is precisely where you haven't upheld this standard that you are otherwise upholding around the world, and so there are criticisms. But I think it would be wrong to see it out of proportion or out of the overall context.
Karine.
I think I would just cite two examples. After the tsunami hit Southeast Asia, it was the United States that was the first to respond to the largely Muslim world out there. Good. And has contributed more than many of the rich Muslim countries. And seeing soldiers hand out water bottles and food supplies to many people of those devastated regions left a huge impact, a positive impact on them. And that was quite a turning point. And I believe the United States can do more in providing assistance where it is most needed. Because what we have learned from September 11th is that problems in the rest of the world can come and haunt us. The other issue that I would refer to is now the United States working with the EU3 on the Iran issue. I believe that is a major move forward in working through partnership in resolving those global issues that not just threaten the United States or threaten any specific country, but threaten us all. And I believe through partnership, and since the United States is the sole superpower, by looking at both sides of any conflict and trying to be balanced in that approach will go a long way in reestablishing that moral high ground.
Okay. I think we'll take another question. We're coming to the end of our time, but I think we've time for one more question.
During the last four... Is this on?
Yes. Yeah.
During the last 4 days, those of us fortunate enough to have been a part of the Ideas Festival have talked about the moral ground a great deal. at a high moral ground, getting back to it, and we've talked about terrorism. And we've realized that, like in the days after the Cold War, one of the reasons we did well was because we had the moral high ground, and we don't now. As an American, and following up on your point, sir, there are certain things that perhaps would involve giving something up as Americans, whether it's Kyoto, whether it's WTO. There are various things that will cost our country something, but if we give them up, perhaps we can take a step towards gaining that high ground, which both ethically and morally and in the world, the view of the world around us could help us. And I'd like to have the opinions of the panel as to if you are in our shoes or in our government's shoes, which simple but politically difficult steps would you take to let us regain that high ground? Thank you.
Who would like to respond to that?
Well, since I believe you already are occupying the high ground, I cannot add much to that. But let me. One thing I would say that the U.S. could be much more in communication and explaining. And sometimes what it seems self-evident and self-explanatory here may seem differently overseas or far away. So I think in terms of public diplomacy, there is more to be done in trying to convey the American message.
Any other takers? Yes.
Well, the only thing I would like to add is, I mean, that in my opinion, there is more at stake than only foreign policy. What is going on with the American society, which was, you know, so discussed lengthily at a festival. What's going on here with poverty? What are you doing with education? What are you doing with healthcare? You must understand that in Europe, when we talk about Americanization of our society, we talk about a situation in which people are left alone, in which people are not taken care for, in which you're dealing with something which becomes totally superficial, and so on and so forth. Now, I do hope that in my remarks I already made clear that in my perception there are many Americans, and that America is a continent full of its own contradictions with the very best and the very worst. But what is at stake, much more or next to foreign policy, is what is right now happening with your own society, and do you think that you live up to your own standards of what democracy should be all about?
Okay, well, that's a good note to end.
Now, if I can briefly add another point, which is that while we're talking about America internally, you know, the title of this panel is International Perspectives on America, and I think I'd like to make a plea for more international perspectives in America.
Yeah.
I think it'd be healthy for... It would be wonderful if America not only took collectively more of an interest in the outside world, but had more opportunities to do so. I've raised this issue with the media when Katie Couric and Bob Schieffer were speaking about the dramatic decline in coverage of world affairs in mainstream American television. I think it's extremely important, not just for in the world's interest, but in America's own interest, that there be much more readily available sources of information about the rest of the world, so that Americans can grow up better informed, therefore better engaged, and therefore will never have to ask themselves questions such as the question they asked themselves after 9/11, why do they hate us? It's important that America already knows where there is hatred, where there is love, what causes which, and what can be done about either. And I think to do that, you need a lot more international perspectives in America.
Thank you very much for coming. I'm afraid we've run out of time. We've gone over our time slightly, but I hope you think it was worth it. I thought it was fascinating. Please join me in thanking our speakers.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.